continuity, let's come back and do the closing page of the screenplay, Stellar, page 112. Scarb says, well, for 1,000 light years at least, this is the only starship. Breeson, this and the pair to the Fantasy orbiting alongside of it. Yes, our paired home base. Neith, perhaps all interstellar travel was done in pairs of starships to give a safety factor. Breeson, or a balance. Say, perhaps our adventurer people came from one of these starships and the corporate set from the other. Persea, the bird woman. Whatever, for me, for my kind, for my world, the now obvious certainty is that your species mastered the art of living in their entire star system. And long ago, yours evolved into a stellar species while mine remained only planetary. CG, that could be. We're now ready to learn much and open many mysteries. Perhaps we are all ready, at last, to become an interstellar species for real. We will find out. Glean, let's head for the pilot chamber. It should be about 5 miles away. They pick up the pace and begin jogging away into the cavernous space, leaving a polished trail across the centuries of dust. Spontaneously, they begin to hum. The humming spreads, and then they all are heard in the distance singing together. The singing echoes vaguely. As their lighted party dwindles away, the robots have begun to hum bass counterpoint to the singing as they all pass out of the enormous lobby into the ship proper. The sense of wonder is the keystone to the science fiction vision. The wonder is that there is a not only a refinement of species, but an array of many species beyond any possible conception. We talked this morning about a pair of writers. The pair that were most interested at the beginning of this 1939-1941 breakthrough threshold, the two who were most interested in the refinement of man were A.E. Van Vogt and Theodore Sturgeon. And the two who were most interested in the sociological effects of technology on society were Robert A. Heinlein and Isaac Asimov. Now, Asimov and Heinlein were co-workers in World War II at the research and development engineering of the Navy Yard in Philadelphia. And here's a photograph of Robert A. Heinlein and Isaac Asimov, young men, and in between them is L. Sprague de Camp, another science fiction writer. And below are those three same men decades and decades later. Heinlein by that time was bald, and Asimov had very long hair and beard, and de Camp quite a beautifully ancient man. He loved to write stories about the Middle Ages on far planets where they had swords and shields just like we did, only they were very alien people. The science fiction vision became, in terms of Heinlein and Asimov, refined early in 1941. And in this issue of May 1941 of Astounding Science Fiction was the presentation for the first time of Robert Heinlein's future history outline. It appeared with an editorial page. The editorial page was called Brass Tacks. And here it reads, on the next two pages in semi-graphical form is the Heinlein history. Robert Heinlein's background suggests a suggestion of the history of the near future. And it lists 10 stories between August of 1939 and May of 1941. Then followed two pages that had the complex future history all outlined, not only of the 10 stories he had written by that time, but of stories to be written further down the line, which he did. And then he would do biographical charts. These lines are the dates of major characters and how they would overlap. And this was extraordinary because it's very reminiscent of William Faulkner. Faulkner developed his stories because the characters in his stories were all interrelated in one little county of Mississippi called Jefferson County. Then Jefferson is the city, but the Indian name for the county was Yoknapatawpha. And so Heinlein has a very interesting thing. He and Asimov, in fact, have a very interesting thing. They have a future history in a universe that doesn't feature aliens. One of the peculiar things about Asimov is that the challenge for man in the future doesn't concern aliens, it concerns the refinement of robots. And that robots become much more evolved faster than man can keep pace of programming them, of controlling them. And in fact, the first two stories that he published in Astounding were both part of what became the positronic robot tales, that the robot brains do not work by electrons, their electrical setup is by the opposite of electrons, positrons. And because of the positronic brain, the robots are able to evolve not only much faster, but much more comprehensively, because in a way they see behind what we're able to perceive and to conceive. They see the other side of it faster, where we don't see the other side. And so the robot stories, the second robot story is called Liar with an exclamation mark. And later on, Asimov's robots developed an ability to go into, the first novel was called The Caves of Steel. A planet which is steel. Later, Lucas in Star Wars would make the Death Star as like a little version of this. Asimov was a giant planet made out of steel, and that many of the groups of humans lived in the caves of steel. And they were assisted by positronic robots to protect them from really bad robots that like to cruise the surface. And that one of them was an extraordinary positronic robot named R. Daniel Uliwa, and was assigned to work with a psychic detective, a Sherlock Holmes who traced a murderer by psychic means. And so the positronic robot had to learn to interface with a psychic detective. And later on, a sequel to The Caves of Steel was called The Naked Sun, where they come back to the surface and realize that this is a completely different thing. When man lives within his technological worlds, he has certain characteristics and responses which can be read characteristically and as responses. But when you get out into the naked sun, all of a sudden, You have to throw the odds out of the window. Almost anything can happen. The most profound thing that happened is that while writing these first two robot stories, he lived in New York. His father ran a candy store in Brooklyn. Candy, ice cream, and magazines, and that's where the young kid, Isaac Asimov, started seeing the covers of these science fiction magazines that his father was selling, and he started reading them. And being precocious, and realizing that, well, the editor is just over there in Manhattan, in New York City, I think I'll go and visit him and take him a story or two. And when he found out that you can get paid for such brash inquiries, and that the editor was interested in listening to a gawky little teenager from Brooklyn, that he began to get interested in listening to the wisdom of this older man, John W. Campbell Jr., engineering background, a science fiction writer himself in the 1930s. His most famous story, he published under the name Don Stewart, and his most famous story was called Who Goes There, which was the basis of the movie The Thing. So one day, while Asimov is in his office, the science writer, Willy Ley, originally from Germany and scooted to the United States when the Nazis took over in 1933, became a writer of science and science stories that were featured in Astounding, and later he had a column for many years in Galaxy, science fiction magazine. One of the things that came up, it reads this way in Asimov's autobiography, the first volume, called In Memory Yet Green. In one of my talks with Campbell, he had told me of the discovery of uranium fission. This is late 1940. And of the obvious conclusion that a chain reaction could be set up, that energy could be delivered at such a rate as to produce an unprecedented cataclysmic explosion. He was very convincing because he was very right. Enough had come out about fission for any intelligent person knowledgeable in atomic physics to deduce it before scientists had self-censored themselves into silence. Campbell even told me that Columbia had a cubic foot of uranium they were experimenting with. I grew uneasy and said I was nervous about working at Columbia under those conditions. Why? Said he. Do you think you would be any safer in Brooklyn if that uranium exploded? Actually, he was in error here. The kind of uranium that Columbia was working with could not have exploded. But this was the first hint I had of an atomic bomb and what it could do. And this was in February 1941. I promptly had incorporated what I had learned about it in a story called Super Neutron, published in February of 1941. Campbell was an extraordinary editor in that he would seed incredible ideas with his writers. And one of his writers, named Clive Cartmell, wrote a science fiction novelette, a short story expanded, not quite yet into a novel, that was so accurate that the FBI came to investigate the Astounding Science Fiction offices about an intelligence leak. And they finally, interestingly, decided that this author had happened on the exact right processes in the exact right order by just sheer genius and editorial goading from Campbell Jr. And so they decided, instead of censoring them, they would let them write more science fiction stories so that no one would suspect that they had already let the cat out of the bag. And so Astounding became the only magazine in the world that carried stories that were accurate about atomic bombs, atomic energy, and in a way, two of the most powerful writers of that era, Robert A. Heinlein and Isaac Asimov, both decided that Campbell was right, that there needs to be a future history like a visionary prophetic map of time, of events, of characters, put into stories that could actually turn out to be quite true, literally a future history. So, in Asimov's own account, on the 1st of August 1941, I took the subway to Campbell's office after class was over. On the way down, he was in graduate school at Columbia, in chemistry. On the way down, I racked my brain for a story idea. Failing, I tried a device I sometimes used. I opened a book at random and then tried free association beginning with whatever I saw. The book I had with me was a collection of the Gilbert and Sullivan plays. I opened it to Iolantha, to the picture of the fairy queen throwing herself at the feet of Private Willis the sentry. Thinking of sentries, I thought of soldiers, of military empires, of the Roman Empire, of the Galactic Empire. Aha! The fate of a story called Pilgrimage was rankling me. Not only had Campbell rejected it four times, but another editor, Pohl, had rejected it twice, and amazing once, seven rejections in all. It was a future historical, and I still wanted to write a future historical. Why shouldn't I write of the fall of the Galactic Empire and the return of feudalism? Written from the viewpoint of someone in the secure days of a second Galactic Empire. I thought I knew how to do it, for I had read Edward Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire from first page to last at least twice. I had only to make use of that. I was bubbling over by the time I got to Campbell's, and my enthusiasm was catching. It was perhaps too catching, for Campbell blazed up as I had never seen him do. "That's too large a theme for a short story," he said. "What?" I said weakly. "Short stories, novelettes, serials, all fitting into a particular future history involving the fall of the First Galactic Empire, the period of feudalism that follows in the rise of the Second Galactic Empire." "What?" I said more weakly. "Yes, I want you to write an outline of the future history. Go home and write the outline." There, Campbell had made a mistake. Robert Heinlein was writing what he called a future history series. He was writing various stories that fitted into one niche or another of the series. He wasn't writing them in order. Therefore, he had prepared a future history outline that was very detailed and complicated so that he could keep everything straight. Now, Campbell wanted me to do the same. Heinlein, however, was Heinlein, and Asimov was not Heinlein. In the photo that we showed Heinlein and Asimov working together in naval scientific research in 1940s. Heinlein was the head. Heinlein had been a graduate of Annapolis. He had been in the Navy, then contracted as a young man tuberculosis and had to be retired out of the Navy. But being Heinlein, he was put in charge of scientific research and development for the Navy Yard in Philadelphia. And it's curious, because we know now in retrospect that the United States Navy was the contact organization for the contact with alien spacecraft and alien beings. Not the Army, not the Air Force, not the State Department, but the United States Navy. And so the Navy was in charge, and always an admiral of the Navy was one of the top secret people for 60 years handling the UFO cover-up, for instance. Asimov and Heinlein were involved together in World War II of doing exactly the kind of research that dovetailed into exactly the kind of science fiction visions that they were developing. The great science fiction future history that Asimov developed is called the Foundation series, and the first three novels published as the original Foundation trilogy, voted on as being the greatest science fiction series ever written by science fiction fans. And the very first novel was called Foundation, and it is so famous that Bantam put out 3 hours of Asimov reading from selections from Foundation in tapes, and you can find these on the internet. There are six sets of three-hour tapes. Others are reading them, but the first one is Asimov reading himself. The second was called Foundation and Empire, and when it was first published in paperback, they changed the name, The Man Who Upset the Universe. And the blurb read this way. Taran and Beta were young and they had faith in the laws of psychohistory and the great future it promised them through the Foundation. Supported by their beliefs, they daringly made plans to combat the desperate war thrust of the colossal galactic empire, and then suddenly they were confronted with an enemy they hadn't counted on, one even more powerful and dangerous than the empire. People called this new foeman the Mule. They said he was a mutant, but no one really knew because no one had ever seen him. But one thing was obvious, the laws and lessons of human psychology and history were useless in coping with this monster. For Asimov, the problem was not aliens, but the mutational exception to the human species who would outdistance us as far as we outdistance apes. One of the progenitors of that theme was a British science fiction writer, Olaf Stapleton. He wrote in the 30s, and I'll bring a copy in next week, a novel called Odd John. Odd John is a human mutant who has an IQ of 2 million. Who organizes in such a complex layering that no one can even understand, even by the wildest psychic intuitions and guesswork, what's going on. And the Mule is quite similar to this. The Mule is able to physiologically change his look, his size, his capacities, his personality. So at one point, he parades himself as an itinerant guitar player who entertains on starships just to keep people happy. While they're searching all over the galaxy for this character to try and find some way to deal with him, the third is called Second Foundation. And the trilogy became so indispensable to the mythology of science fiction, to the art of science fiction writing, to the future history outlines of people, that Asimov finally was forced to write a fourth novel. So he wrote Foundation's Edge, and then it was so acclaimed that they worked on him, and finally, just before he died, he finished the seventh Foundation novel, Forward the Foundation. But people by this time had made it one of the great mythic adventures of all time. like an Alice in Wonderland. So the Asimov Foundation and his widow, Janet Asimov, got three of the most famous science fiction writers of the 1990s to each write a novel, a new second trilogy of the Foundation. I'll bring them in next week. And one of the themes of that second trilogy is that by going into space, humankind exposed to the vast complexities of who knows what kind of energies and frequencies, suffered what they called the chaos, a kind of a long fever disease that scrambled your molecules of neural capacities, and sometimes they discovered it would last for centuries, that everyone on the planet would be ill and not know it for centuries, for millennia, and that many planets must have suffered this. One of the peculiarities also is that Heinlein and Asimov, though they were quite different in emphasizing the sociological effects of technology upon man, were tuned to Van Vogt and Sturgeon, who were writing about the refinement of man's capacities. I mentioned last week Theodore Sturgeon, who in 1954 won the International Fantasy Award for his novel More Than Human, about six people, one of them a mongoloid baby who's only three in the crib but can levitate trucks and various things, one the village idiot called Lone, two black girl twins who are able to telekinetically do all kinds of things, and two other, and they together form a gestalt being, homo gestalt, and that they do not think of themselves as we but as I. And Van Vogt, who in the mid-40s came to understand that there is a way to remove the backing of the mirror mind, so that instead of there being a mirror mind, one now is able to look prismatically through the mind and to engender a second mind, a hyper mind, which is the mind of the mind. And that this gives the capacity, the protagonist in that novel, it's called The World of Null A, the world of non-Aristotelian thought. The protagonist is Dutch, and his name is pronounced Gilbert Gosain. And he is trying to discover the capacities that he has because he has two minds. And that the second mind comes into play only when the original Gilbert Gosain dies, that he will have to undergo a death before the second Gilbert Gosain of him comes in with both minds. And it's very scary for him to try to find out why this is so and to realize increasingly that it's only by his death that this will be able to happen. And that all of those arrayed against him, a very complex intergalactic combine, a cabal of very devious beings, decide that if they kill the second Gilbert Gosain, they will have erased this mutant confrontation, which they do in the second follow-up, The Players of Null A. And the last page has the second Gilbert Gosain dead at the top, and at the bottom, the third Gilbert Gosain wakes up in a galactic, transparent coffin case, ready for real action. The science fiction writer who stole that image was Arthur C. Clarke, who gave it to Stanley Kubrick. So at the end of 2001, you see the baby in the glass bubble above the Earth. That came from Van Vogt in the 1940s. The quality of the science fiction vision is that it is a spiritual, jewel-like array of opening up. And in the very tail end of the 50s and the beginning of the 1960s, there was a maturation, an evolution, a refinement of science fiction writers, so that you had a pair of writers who both tried to crisscross between these two pairs, the refinement of man and the refinement of the technological sociology of man, which is going to be a challenge. And those two writers, one was named Frank Herbert, who did the Dune series. The other was Philip K. Dick, who did the emphasis on the Sturgeon Van Vogt series, that it could be that Homo sapiens was really an animal compared to some of the variants that were going to come out. And so you have all kinds of Philip K. Dick stories that have been made into films. And Dune has been made three times. Once into a film, then into a television series, then into a very refined, expanded television series. And not only are there six Dune novels by Frank Herbert, his son and another science fiction writer have added another seven. They're working on an eighth, so that there is almost a shelf of books about this. What is peculiar and interesting is that coming into the 21st century, one finds not further science fiction writers, but science beginning to explore these possibilities, so that 21st century science more and more is outstripping the fictional vision, even the revised fictional vision. So that there is this sense of the threshold, the wave that is here now is building up in the shallows of an incomplete background of an insufficient species, that this energy wave is building into this large tsunami and is beginning to crest, and that the only way to survive is to be able to surf the pipeline of the cresting wave, which requires beyond an ultimate courage. That's why this series is called the Parayana, the way behind. To surf a curling wave, one has to be able to ride the curl and just veer very slightly toward shore. You cannot get out of it. You cannot challenge it, and so you have to develop an athletic patience and an seamless quality of participation where the wave does not challenge you. You are a part of the motion of the curl of that threshold. That time threshold curve is at a point to where it's almost a complete tunnel. By 2016, we will have been able to ride through it and come through it. Because the curious thing, spiritually, about all in tune with that spirit capacity, it only takes one surf rider to be able to do that. All will have achieved that. Because it is commutable, it's shareable, and this is one of the great spiritual mysteries. As long as in the cosmos there is one prismatic being that has done this, then all can participate, just as if you tune a bow, and on that cello you play an A sharp, all other cellos in the room will vibrate to that. They will hum A sharp. If you do a G minor, they will all be G minor. The resonance sharing capacity is there in the way in which energy frequencies are able to modulate. Out of the uncounted trillions of trillions of trillions of trillions of trillions, phone book long, of electrons in the universe, they all have the same energy frequency. And they all can jump to the next energy frequency, that of the muon, which is also precise in the fact that every muon in the cosmos is that energy frequency, and can jump a third time to the tau particle level. And one of the curious things is that the neutrinos of the electron, the muon, and the tau, in which we're always in a trillions upon trillions upon trillions blizzard, in 1 cubic nanometer, there are trillions upon trillions of neutrinos, and they hop, skip, and jump between the three energy levels of electron, muon, tau, all the time, like acrobats. If subatomic particles can do this, spiritual beings can put on a really good show. More next week.